Now playing in Los Angeles, exquisite food and drink, world-class art everywhere, spectacular sports, dazzling Hollywood attractions. L.A. offers the full variety of food scene, from game-changing taco trucks to 35 Michelin stars. And did you know that Los Angeles has more museums and theaters than New York City? Get your fix in music, film, comedy, and world-class museums. Plus, get behind the scenes in movie magic with a world-famous studio tour. That's something that should be on everyone's bucket list. Start here with discoverla.com. When you hear that Mint Mobile wireless plans are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan, you're probably thinking, what's the catch? Well, there isn't one. Mint Mobile is here to rescue you with premium wireless plans for just $15 a month. Say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages. All plans come with unlimited talk and text and high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all your existing contacts. Our producer, Sean, is a big Mint Mobile guy. Here's what he had to say.
For a fraction of the cost, Mint Mobile proved to have excellent coverage with no drop calls or unsent texts. Plus, they make it super easy for me to activate my device just by following a few simple steps online. And bam, done. It was great.
To get this new customer offer and your new three-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/literally. That's mintmobile.com/literally. And cut your wireless bills to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/literally. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Hello, Literally listeners. For the next few weeks, I'm showcasing some of my favorite podcast episodes. And today's incredibly special to me. Please enjoy my chat with the spectacular Demi Moore.
Oh, there you are.
There you are. There you are.
There you are. Where are you?
I'm in a, what do they call it? Where do they put like the one person during the State of the Union so that you survive a nuclear blast? Oh, an unsecured location.
Yes.
Which happens to be my basement.
Welcome to the podcast. So there are certain people in a career that you are always affiliated with. People always think of you, you know, in the collaborations that you've done together. And there's just something about Demi Moore, above and beyond the fact that she's a tremendous movie star, fashion icon, author, and has a new podcast called Dirty Diana.
Wow.
Which is where our conversation begins. You know, provocateur, headline grabber, all the things that we know about beautiful, great voice, all the things that we know about Demi. But there's something about her that has always captured people's imagination. And the two of the movies that we did together about last night and St. Elmo's Fire are, I think, kind of emblematic of a very specific time and place. And so there's a lot to unpack with Demi. So buckle up for this one. This is I think the one you've been waiting for. Demi Moore.
When I read that you were doing this, I was like, oh, wait one fucking second. This is gonna be my girl Demi with that voice that the world loves and erotica. I'm fucking in. I'm in it to win it. But it's I thought you would like literally be reading something, but you're performing. It's a performance series. Is it unfair to say it's like what would have been a radio show in the 30s?
No,
but now
very,
it's a podcast?
100%. That is what it is. I mean, it's got all of the Foley sound, you know, you have to find the way in which to help the audience move to being, you're now in another room, you know, with sounds. And what's interesting is after, you know, when I started to hear the episodes cut together, you know, there's subtle things as actors that we communicate that only through visual do you, can you, you know, that is kind of felt and, you know, and seen through a slight look where the voice may be expressing something different. So it was a really interesting learning curve, you know, realizing that in some ways you have to be more literal.
Mm. I learned a lot from your podcast. And one is, like you said, the Foley, by the way, for the non-professionals out there, the Foley is when, like, you go into a studio and you make footsteps. Like, all the stuff that you've ever seen on screen, half of it has never been recorded. It's been recorded afterward, and that process is called foleying. And my favorite was the first time I ever went to a Foley stage, watching a love scene being foleyed. So you can imagine what they do to create those lovemaking noises. And let me just say, it's fucking gross. And it can make you never want to see a love scene. So they take their own hands and they go...
Oh, by the way, by the way, we did kiss our own hands. We did. I mean, it was, did have to do a few of those. I'm not going to do it. It was very difficult trying to time some moments in the love scene that I had to do in this. At least it's equally as awkward as doing it on film. you know, this podcast is something that's really interesting and beautiful. Shauna Feste, who wrote it, based this on her relationship with her husband. And, you know, it's very, very personal. And I've never seen something written where it starts with the couple really fractured, who end up coming together. So Shauna and her husband were at a really low place. They had stopped having sex. Their, you know, relationship ended. They had no communication and certainly no communication about sex. And they ended their marriage. He had a girlfriend, she had a boyfriend, and they found their way back. And they today now have three kids, and he produced the podcast. So it's, there was something about that separate than, you know, just the aspect of the podcast being, you know, about looking at sex through the female gaze, because porn generally or erotica generally has been geared towards the male gaze. And, you know, like it's filmed badly. The stories are bad. I don't believe it. You know, we all know this, like, you know, cookie cutter orgasm sound that's fake as fuck. And so we wanted to have something that actually, like, was an honest reflection of what it is for a woman. And it's an interesting thing because I realized we're not taught about orgasm. And I feel like young men, they figure it out.
We figure it out.
Whether they want to or not.
Oh, we figure it out.
So then what happens is you're like, hey, I know how I work. You get with a girl, you don't know how she works. We require a little bit more finesse. We don't know how we work. You don't know how we work. And so then we're left where it's kind of quickly over and it's like, okay, that was it. So it puts us already at a point of disconnection at the word go. So if we were educated in a way that actually made this conversation just more normal and more open, like understanding, like I sat in, I don't know if you probably didn't, but I sat in on my kid's sex ed class. And I was like, they spoke about disease and fear of being pregnant, male orgasm, because that gets you pregnant. And that was it. I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Where's the other discussion?
So, I want to be in that eighth grade class where they hit you with that. And then Demi Moore's in the back room went, whoa, 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 wait, what about my orgasm?
Hey, It's an important element in changing the future of this that, it's really important. It's really important to kind of blast this wide open because there's a lot of conditioned shame that resides still. And it's uncomfortable. It's an uncomfortable conversation for a lot of people.
What's the reaction been for you? Like what have people,
I would say the big thing that's come back is finally, that's like been one of them. I think we've been in quarantine. So I've heard everything from the best sex I've had the whole quarantine to, I now need a few minutes alone. But I think that those are the lighthearted ones. I think overall, it's been extremely positive.
I can't wait to go hear more of them. It's an amazing journey, and welcome to the podcast world.
Yes. It's great to have this new outlet in a different way to create. We have received offers to turn this into a show, and so that may very well happen.
That'd be awesome.
Which would be fun too.
We've never talked about, I don't think in any great detail, is our mutual Aaron Sorkin experience. And
no, we have.
I watched, A Few Good Men is one of those movies that, like The American President, like other movies, like when it's on, you're fucked. Like if you, God help you, if you have somewhere to be, and you turn on the television and A Few Good Men's on, it's over. You're done. You're not going to be wherever you're going. You're done. And you're amazing at it. I don't even know if you knew that that after The West Wing, Aaron and I did a new version of A Few Good Men on the West End.
I didn't know that.
Yes, we did 260 performances at the Royal Haymarket Theater. So I'm very well versed in that, and you're so good in that. You're great in everything, but. What's your takeaway? Do you have any real memory of what's your best A Few Good Men?
There's a few. One, I had to audition for A Few Good Men.
Of course, yes, Aaron.
Eight months pregnant, by the way. So like I think Tom has expressed that he was like extremely like almost like embarrassed, uncomfortable. Obviously, like you, I had known him. For a long time.
Right,
and
right.
So like seeing me in this huge belly having to do the scenes was just, it was just funny. that was memorable. And then,
Was Aaron there? Was Aaron Sorkin there?
He was there a lot.
Was he there at the audition?
No, he wasn't there at the audition.
Because he read with me. He was my acting partner in the audition.
Oh, wow. Well, that would have
been
great.
You had Tom Cruise as your acting partner. So you were clearly in a better frame of mind.
Put it this way, it was a better audition for me than when I had to audition for Top Gun, that I did really well on the audition and then tanked the screen test.
Wait. How do you tank a screen test?
I don't know. I just
for Top Gun. Were you like in a green screen and a jet pilot? No, because you were playing the Kelly McGillis role.
Yes. I think I just like got too in my head, got too nervous, and tanked it.
You would have been got the notion of you and Tom in Top Gun. And Kelly McGillis is great, but that's so good.
But what's interesting, the other thing about, to go back to your question about other memorable moments, and I included it in my book, which is, there was a real push from the executives for there to be a love scene between Tom and I in A Few Good Men. And just the subject matter and the whole tone, it was never there, on Broadway and it just wasn't right. It's what made it interesting is that it wasn't there, but that particular time period. And so there was an interview that Aaron gave, which I didn't know until I saw this later, where when he was being pushed to make a love scene, and the executive said, if there's not going to be a love scene, then what's Demi Moore doing in it?
Jesus.
Like, essentially, why is there a woman in it? What's the point? What's my value? Which was so I don't know, kind of indicative of the time period.
Yeah, for sure.
You know,
yeah.
But I just am so grateful that he and Rob both stuck to the truth, keeping it, you know, authentic to what it should have been, which made it more interesting, you know.
Oh, totally.
The relationship.
That's one of those stories that you know is true. From a studio executive at that era, mm-hmm. some dude said that.
Definitely. Definitely. It was like not at that. Yeah, you're right. There was no reach for that.
There's no reach. And for those of you who are not doing the math on this, Aaron Sorkin wrote West Wing, wrote A Few Good Men, wrote American President, and he's notorious. And he's a guest, upcoming guest on the podcast. But here's what was interesting. When I did West Wing, we would talk about A Few Good Men because it's an iconic thing. The movie is iconic. But people forgot how iconic the play was before the movie. The movie has taken up mm-hmm. so much space in people's imagination, justifiably. It's you and Tom, giant stars and a huge hit.
Jack.
Rob Ryan. Jack! I mean,
Jack,
come on.
Come on.
And
you want us on that.
Oh,
anyway, go on.
It's the best. Do you know what I watched the other day? Here's the scene I watched. You can have all the paperwork you want, but you're going to have to ask me nicely. I'm sorry?
Oh.
And like, you're right there in like three steps behind Tom and all the coverage. For this unbelievable.
Yes, it's
what?
So intense.
It's so intense. And what was it like to be there for Jack throwing down like that?
You know what? First of all, you know, when we look at actors that we just look up to and where you're being shown the right way to do something. So in the big courtroom scene that was Jack's big day, they shot everything the other direction first. So it was like on the courtroom when he took the stand.
By the way, for those of you who listen, courtroom scenes for actors and dinner table scenes are horrible because you have to shoot everybody. So think of how many people are in a courtroom. So literally before Jack gets on camera, he's done it 60, 70 times.
So many times. So, and, you know, doing all the different actors' coverage and he literally gave like 110 the entire fucking day.
No way.
Like, I mean, I'm telling you, like, I kept thinking, wow, like, he's going to lose his voice. So what's there on camera was literally the end of the day. And I'm sure that, you know, Rob may have, you know, given him the option and maybe he wanted it that way because it was such a big scene. But that was like one of those things where you just, like, looking at someone that you really look up to, where mm-hmm. you just know, like, that's somebody who's like showing you the right way to be. They're showing up for the other actors generously, no matter who they are or where they're at. And it was, I just like had such appreciation for watching him that day and every day. The only day that, you know, was interesting is that, you know, we know how much he loves the Lakers, and there was the big day when they were going to, when Magic Johnson was going to give the news conference that he was HIV positive. So the sun was going down, we're shooting the Guantanamo thing, and we couldn't get Jack out of his trailer because he was like waiting.
Yeah.
And didn't want to miss that moment.
I'm sure.
Other than that, it was just like, great. It was easy. It was Jack. No pressure.
It's so funny because, you know, Jack, again, one of my idols, certainly, and coming up and even living on, I think I ended up living on Mulholland as a young actor because Jack lived on Mulholland and Warren Beatty lived on Mulholland. And I think I got Lakers seats because that's what you build your life around, you know, what you think is cool and your heroes. And there's something about Jack who's cool personified. And somehow there's, at least for me, in my perception, there was always like, it was just surprising to me, his workman-like ethic with coolness. Like, you don't associate workman-like and craftsmanship and humility with cool, right?
No, you're 100% right. Like, you think of it as, you know, somebody who's breaking the rules.
Yes.
Like, you know, they're.
Oh, Jack, he didn't show up till 5 o'clock every day, but everybody waited for him. And oh, God, he came out of his trailer and he was drunk as a skunk. But man, when the camera was on, he really put it together. All that bullshit you hear about other people.
He definitely was not that. He was highly professional, highly, you know, like he set a standard that you also wanted to like live up to, wanted to reach, which was great.
I'm inspired third hand hearing it from a story that happened many years ago. It's like,
but you know, it's like those are the things where you just like you step back and just like feel such a depth of gratitude for all that we've experienced and seen and done.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
Thanks to Quince, I can get high-end, versatile pieces at fantastic prices. They've got killer luxury essentials that are perfect for my wardrobe. Quince has all the must-haves, like Mongolian cashmere crew neck sweaters from $50, iconic 100% leather jackets, and versatile flow knit activewear. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of middlemen and passes that savings on to us. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. One of my producers tried Quince, and here's what he had to say.
I'm really excited to revamp my closet with Quince. There are so many great options at pretty unbeatable prices. I'm really excited to try out the burgundy cashmere crew neck. I love the blue chore jacket. Maybe I'll throw some joggers in there. These are great options at pretty unbeatable prices.
Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/rob for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince, quince.com/rob to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rob.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. I know that for me, people are out, people are about, people want to do stuff, and we want to do it, but it can be a grind. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapist at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/roblow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/roblow.
I love fast cars, but there aren't a ton of high performance EVs. They're certainly out here there. But when I get a chance to get behind the wheel of one, I love it. And I was blown away by the Kia EV6 GT. When you get behind the wheel of the Kia, it is literally like being in a state-of-the-art rocket ship, but also comfortable. The thing goes from 0 to 60 in 3.4 seconds. It is the premium driving experience. And of course, it's an EV. So the climate thanks you. SiriusXM provides access to over 165 channels in the vehicle. Music, sports, news, comedy, yacht rock. Let's go. Little Steely Dan going in your Kia. Come on now. So check it out today. It is the all-electric Kia EV6 GT. I had a blast checking it out. Believe me, you should do it yourself via kia.com/EV6 to learn more. That is kia.com/EV6. Kia, movement that inspires.
It's such sad news that our buddy Joel Schumacher has left us. I had no idea that he was sick. Having just text exchanges.
Joel, for those of you, Joel directed St. Elmo's Fire, among other, and Flatliners and Batman, and I mean, and just on and on and on. But he was a huge part of our life, and that's how you and I met.
Yep.
In his office. It's the first time I ever remember seeing you. Actually, it's not true. I remember seeing you walk onto the lot. So I was going to ask you this because there are... Oh, I wasn't going to ask you this. I was not going to ask you this for fear that you wouldn't remember the first time you saw me and my ego would be crushed.
It might be possible. I have some big...
Big black spots?
I do have some things. Yeah. I mean, maybe my hard drive is just so full that I...
Yeah, maybe that's it.
I've got to unload. I'm serious. There is like some gaps of shit I don't remember. And then there's other stuff that I remember so detailed that it's like annoying.
I know. Well, I remember the first time I saw you because I was, so there was this script called St. Elmo's Fire. It was floating around and it was a kind of an it script and everybody loved it. But I fancied myself as a lead in movies already and wasn't going to sully my hands with being in an ensemble. Certainly. But I kept hearing about this script and this script and this script. I mean, I had just worked with the great Tony Richardson on Hotel New Hampshire, don't you know, which is going to be nominated for an Oscar. And of course, did not. I don't think anybody saw it. Anyway, so I was very fancy. And but then eventually I broke down and read the script and it was fucking great. And I really fell in love with the role of Billy Hicks, the drunken saxophone playing womanizing. Gee, I wonder why. I wonder what part of that.
Well, I wonder what your draw was.
I don't know. What do you think that was? Drunken, womanizing, music loving. I didn't. Big stretch. So, but they wanted me to play the Judd Nelson role. Like they were not interested in me. And this is actually kind of amazing.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
They did not. They couldn't comprehend that I could be a bad boy. I showed them, by the way. But they could not comprehend, like, I was like this preppy, pretty, sort of well-raised, do-gooding Ohio. Like, and so they were like, they weren't going to do it. So I had to go and meet Joel. It wasn't really an audition, but I had to go and like kiss the ring for this fucking ensemble. So I go to the lot to meet Joel Schumacher. I look down, you know, Warner Brothers is that amazing, iconic lot. It's at the end of Blazing Saddles. It's iconic. There's something about that lot that is iconic. And the sun is hitting the buildings perfectly. And this woman walks out into the street and I didn't realize it was you. It was you. You were wearing your hair. And you need to explain this to me. Do you know you're wearing your hair?
No, continue.
Okay. I'm telling you, you'll know, like the story you told me about the studio executive. Like when I tell you how you're wearing your hair, you're going to know it's true because I couldn't possibly make this up.
I mean, so, just knowing the time period, I'm just already imagining something that's so cringeable. So
no, please. It's I remember it how many years later. So did the right thing. Your hair was long, as it always was, and it was, you had a big straw hat on, either a cowboy hat or some kind of a big straw hat on top of your head, but your long hair underneath it was wrapped up and around and on top of, and basically hiding the hat.
Very funny. I can totally, like, I know, like, absolutely, because I have done that before. I mean, there's a lot here, but, you know, like, I can tie it in a bow on the top of my head. But
oh, my God, I'm watching you do this right now. This is, oh, my God, you should have done that. You were like a hair magician.
So funny.
Demi Moore, hair magician. Title,
what was I thinking on this? I mean, I remember, you know, the big thing is that when I came to meet Joel, I was fancying myself as like being kind of, you know, super cool. And I was, you know, riding a motorcycle.
Oh, amazing.
Of course, with no license, because who saw the point in that?
Like, no.
That was just a waste of my time. Really?
I was also I was drunk at the audition.
You were?
Yeah, because they thought I was a square. So
I
physically brought a six pack into the audition. But all it made me do is want to pee the whole time.
Yeah, I could see how that would happen. But it worked. They were like, Joel was going for it. Joel loved having you on the set.
The other thing I love about St. Elmo's Fire is, in this, Joel did this to the day he died. God bless him. Even the most recent photos I saw of Joel, he was the instigator of a trend that didn't ever catch on, but he went down swinging with the trend. And the trend is multiple jackets layered upon each other.
I mean, that's worked.
If you notice in St. Elmo's Fire, I have a Levi jacket and a Letterman's jacket on top of each other, and on and on and on. And that was Joel's thing. He was going to make that a national thing. It just never really happened, I don't think.
I don't know. There's some people that carry that on. I always, you know, Joel always looked to me like...
George O'Keefe?
Yes, a male George O'Keefe. Yeah, he did.
He looked like George O'Keefe.
100%. He did with his look. Well, I am most grateful for him, for sure.
And, you know, the other thing about Joel, and I'm sure that's what you're alluding to because you write about it in your book, which, by the way, is fantastic.
Thank you.
Joel was one of the people who was, you know, was in responsible in you getting sober. And you getting sober, you were the first person I ever knew who got sober. You were. And I don't know, I think I've told you this, but if I haven't, I mean, I can't tell you what that's meant to me and what it did mean to me. And when it was time for me to get sober, I was like, you know, I had somebody that I could, like, I know it worked for. I mean, I think having, for people to know people who it worked, because let's face it, a lot of times it doesn't, and it doesn't take, and all those things. And I don't mean this the way it's going to sound, but I was like, fuck, if she can do it, anybody can do it. And I only mean that because we were fucking wild.
And look, we were super young, which makes it hard to wrap your head around when that should be your time. Like, yeah, this is when we're like trying everything. And, you know, look, Joel was doing for me what he couldn't do for himself because he got sober so many years later. And I didn't realize that, obviously, until he also got sober. But I had never had somebody really champion me. Like, there was no reason. Like, I didn't have any huge box office for him to really be sticking his neck out. It was an ensemble. Mm-hmm. They could have definitely filled that with any you know, number of you know, young and up-and-coming actresses. And, you know, the fact that he allowed me to start the movie with 15 days of sobriety, that they paid for me to have a companion. And that companion, they had to pay for 24/7 for the entire shoot. It just was not heard of, you know? Like, I think anybody else, you know, there's a good chance I would have just been looked at as a liability.
100%. They'd be we'll give you the number two choice.
But meanwhile, it gave me something to value because I didn't value myself enough, that is for sure, to have any reason to be sober. So losing that, and I said this in the book, like I don't know if I would have been able to do it. Like I didn't see myself as worth anything. And so, you know, it's like, I love hearing that reflection supported you in seeing that it was possible, because I think we do help a lot of people even when we don't realize it, or it's indirect. And
right,
but it gives meaning and, you know, helps me to know the value of it. And as somebody who took a interesting detour away from being sober, you know, I really value it even more so now.
Let me ask you something about that. And that's the other thing that's inspiring about you. Is the only thing that's more inspiring about people than people getting sober are the people get sober, fall off the wagon, and then get sober again. That's stud shit.
It's look, as you can imagine in different ways, like opening the door, because I have been sober more of my adult life than not, like practically all of it, I felt so stupid. Like, how stupid that I opened this door when I knew better. I knew that this just doesn't work. I don't have an off switch. I don't have the thing that tells me, particularly with alcohol, that I've had enough. I wish I did. I just don't. But when I opened that door, knowing everything that I know, I felt like I've got to figure out how to manage this. I have to figure out how to make it work, because if I've been stupid enough to open this door, I've got to prove it. And so it made it harder to reach back and it's not get sober. It's just even having to face my choice. That's what it is. It was like my ego didn't want to have to face what the choice I had made. But I will say, once I really turned around, I'm so much more free.
Does it feel different this time though? Like,
I feel like I am staying closer to my support system, more engaged. I feel like I always allowed for the principles, particularly through through the program of AA. But I know if I had stuck closer to the fellowship and meetings, when it was presented to me, the idea of, that maybe alcoholism isn't a real thing, it's just about moderation, it wouldn't have even been something I would have entertained had I stuck close.
Yeah, because people would have been like, what?
So I definitely feel a lot of appreciation. And I also, there's a part of me that can say, oh, why did I need to do that? But I accept that I did need to do it, and for whatever reason. And I am stronger, certainly. I'm stronger and deeper within myself because of it.
It's great. I take great empathy and it's. I'm glad when people come back into the program in recovery and tell me what it's like out there, so I don't have to go do it myself. I had a really good friend who you mutually would know, who was sober forever, but he was young, really young, too, really young, and he was like, I just feel like I want to. I mean, I've been sober. I get it. I'm not going to go use drugs, or I don't want to do any of that. But like, God, I'm young, and like, I'm going to be working in Europe, and it's like, I could have a glass of wine at dinner or whatever. And I'm like, okay. So this is my favorite. So on the flight to Europe to go work, he orders his first glass of wine. Within 6 months, he's in jail for biting a cop in the belly button.
Yowzer.
Go figure. So I'm like,
okay.
It's like, you can almost, like clockwork, when somebody hits you with I was just thinking maybe, when they hit you with that, you can almost start the stopwatch.
Yeah. I mean, I can say I didn't, like, the decline wasn't, like, immediate.
The scariest part in a weird way, right? Maybe?
Well, the effort of negotiating, though, because I don't have a thing that helps me know, like, how much is too much. So it's like that constant effort of negotiating, you've had two. Well, maybe I can have two. It's like the relief of it just being off the table. It's just like, I don't need anything to have a good time. And I have 8.5 years now.
Jesus.
And I had almost 20 before I opened the door. So every once in a while, certainly in the early days of this second go round, my ego really struggled with having to say, I've got 30 days, I've got, 3 months, 6 months, when I would kept comparing like what I would have. But I worked through that, because what I do know is that life is happening for you, not to you. And I just had to open myself up to see what it was trying to give me, and as opposed to what I had lost.
And we'll be right back after this.
Transform your bathroom cleaning with Wet and Forget weekly shower cleaner. You just spray today and rinse tomorrow for a no-scrub clean. With over 33,000 five-star reviews, this is your once-a-week solution to keeping your tub and shower surfaces sparkling clean. Available at Amazon, Lowe's, Menards, Home Depot, and Ace Hardware. Join thousands who've switched to an easier clean. Get your wet and forget weekly shower cleaner today and make your bathroom sparkle with zero scrubbing. Hey, listeners, ever have trouble getting someone on the phone when you have a question about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day, or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card. Join Macy's in an effort to shop more sustainably with brands like Carter's Little Planet, Oak, On 34th, Elemis, and more. Plus, to help bring more parks to more people, Macy's is supporting Trust for Public Lands Community Schoolyards Project, transforming vacant schoolyards into green spaces to help ensure healthy, livable communities for generations to come. Donate online or in store and learn more at macys.com/purpose.
I think Ghost is my favorite Demi Moore movie. Other than About Last Night. Listen, it always feels like About Last Night is a black hole that you never talk about, I never talk about, people never talk about, and yet it's fucking great. You like that movie, right?
I thought it was amazing. And you know what? It really, you know, captured a time. There's so many people that of a certain generation that it completely, connected with, represented. I mean, the moment when I say it's official, I've become my mother. I mean, yeah. Like, I can't tell you how many people have like identified with that. When I'm creeping out after the first time, you know, Danny yes. and Debbie sleep together and I'm like trying to get out of there. That was, you know, that was really a different perspective than the guy slipping out. Right. You know, it was yeah. definitely, you know, an interesting statement of a different time, trying to really reflect that women, you know, were not just waiting for the man.
Well, yeah, it's true. And then the sort of traditional roles were reversed. There's that great sequence that people quote to me all the time, although it's your line that they quote, where I'm suspicious and jealous that you may or may not have been having an affair with a guy at work. And you're like, I don't really think it's any of your business. I'm like, well, did you sleep with him? And you're like, no, Dan, we were bowling partners. And I'm like, oh, so you fucked him. So it's like, I'm cast in like the shrew like role. But that's the one, you know, when people talk about 80s movies and Brat Pack stuff, and for me, that's the one I want people to watch. I love St. Elmo's Fire. It's a different thing. But like About Last Night's a real movie. It's a real movie. It's the performance. You're so good at it. Elizabeth Perkins is
amazing.
Ridiculous.
And Jim.
Jim is born
Jim
to play
Belushi,
that part.
Just so people, for people, other people who don't know. And, I thought it was I felt like it was for us a move to a grown-up movie. Like we went
yeah.
in a way to like, it went from being kids to grown-up. And,
you know, what's amazing about that though, to me, here's what's amazing. And you just said exactly what I always try to tell people and they can't wrap their minds about it. There was a time in the movie business where if you were a 20-something, you could not wait to graduate to real movies or grown-up movies. Those movies don't exist anymore. Now,
yeah, I mean, look, we didn't have, we didn't like, the, we really didn't have a lot of young people in leads of movies.
Like, no.
Think about it. We were doing these ensemble pieces, all the John Hughes stuff. But in general, we didn't have young people. So doing that, like getting into like the serious movies.
Exactly. Real movies. Our movies were never considered. And this is what's great about time. Time weeds out all the bullshit and you remember what's important or whatever. But when we made those movies, the real people didn't give a fuck. They got bad reviews. They were looked at as teen movies and they weren't real movies. Real movies were terms of endearment. By the way, they are real movies. Those movies are amazing. But our movies weren't those. No way. They were like this like side hustle. That the studio.
But I think that's a real reflection that people of a certain age weren't valued. You know, yep. It's like still a little bit of that like holdover from, you know, when kids were still owned as opposed to being their own person. And so thereby there weren't really stories. We were kind of we were part of the beginning of stories about young people. And now you look at it, I mean, they're a whole demographic that are, you know, served and served generously.
Because About Last Night felt like we had graduated to the big leagues. Like we were on our way. We were going to do serious work, and which of course happened, but it's the notion that those earlier movies were the minor leagues. That's what's kind of amazing to look back on.
Well, we can look at it. Now, like there are barely movies at all. So we were definitely
all the movies that the movies I grew up loving, and the movies that inspired me would not be movies today. They, if they were made at all, they would be an 8-part. You're not making Deliverance today. Deliverance. If they make Deliverance today, it's an 8-part Netflix show about a group of guys who get into it on the river. That they'll make it. Deliverance totally gets made today, but it's not a summer movie made with five of the biggest stars. It's just not. I mean, no. Terms of Endearment is not a summer release movie. Midnight Cowboy.
Is a movie
that you would make for scale. And maybe it gets picked up at Sundance. Maybe if you're lucky.
And look, it's different time. And I don't want to like say, oh, one was better over the other. It's definitely different.
Yeah.
Like having something that's in a longer form, which I actually haven't done yet. You know, doing something that's a limited series or I think is also kind of really amazing as an actor to be able to explore a character in a way that evolves. I mean, you've done it both in drama and in comedy, and I just haven't really explored that format yet. But I think there's something great about it. I don't know. What do you think? Yes or no?
I do. I think the difference between sort of movie acting and versus TV and theater acting in particular is you're playing the character in a movie, you're living the character on television just because of the amount of hours that you physically are that person. You know, you're in what's going on in your personal life. It's like you're dealing with grief, or your kid had a birthday party, or you're late to do this. It's like every iteration of life you can imagine you're going to experience during the run of a television show, if it's long enough. There's only so much life experience that you're going to go through in the 4 months or 6 months of a movie. So you are truly living the character, which is, I think, like as you said, it's of equal, totally equal value. And I agree with you. I don't want to be like the man, like the, you know, the old guy, not all day is the movie business, because it's not that there's so much good stuff that would never be done. But the notion that it's the same is crazy tunes. So different.
I mean, look, I've said to my kids for years that the only thing in life that you can count on is change.
Mm.
It's the only true constant.
Yeah. And then, which means we have to have the ability to change with the change. And you know, a lot of people, I mean, and everybody struggles with it. I struggle with it. I'm not an early adapter to stuff. I'm not. And things happen so rapidly. Like, in fact, I'm deeply hence, I didn't ever want to do Planet Hollywood in the 80s. Like, I'm like such a curmudgeon that like anything sort of newfangled. By the way, curmudgeon in the word newfangled. I rest my fucking case. Who else
yeah,
uses
but look at that all, word? I have to like though reflect back to you. Look at how many things though that you've explored and tried. Like
that's true.
You're, you know, going and doing theater in another country, you know, like jumping in to do West Wing. Like that was like at that moment, that was like a really huge leap to step out from having just really been in film to do that. And like there's a lot from then jumping in, you know, to do Parks and Rec, to doing this podcast. So you may come to it a little bit later, but you come to it.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And it's I mean, it's like, it's weird. I'm good at adapting and like to, because I like the challenge and I like the uncertainty and I like the seeing if I can jump off the high dive of it all, of different things in career-wise. And sometimes, by the way, sometimes it gets me into trouble. I mean, there are times, you know, when I famously did a song and dance number with Snow White at the Academy Awards, they asked me to do it. And I was like, yeah, this sounds really great. Sounds scary. And it was a fucking unmitigated disaster. Oh, and you'll love this because you work with Barry Levinson. So like it cuts both ways, right? Like being bold is
right.
Really, really good. But then you also are bold and you find yourself in front of a billion people looking out at the audience doing a song and dance number with Snow White, and all you can see is Barry Levinson's face, and he's about to win 8 Oscars for Rain Man, and his face is literally going, "What the fuck?" That's what I saw looking out at Barry Levinson. And then every year I get to be a punching bag when the Oscars roll around of like most embarrassing Oscars moments. I'm number one. No one's actually. You'd think that when they couldn't figure out how to actually announce the best picture, that maybe that might be more embarrassing. No.
There's a few. I'm sure that you're in some good company.
There's Snow a few. White. And there is some good, but you can't bat 1,000. You know, you can't bat 1,000 and, you know, a 23-year-old kid is not going to say to Marvin Hamlisch, you know, who's won 17 Oscars for The Sting and everything, I don't think the lyrics to this song are kind of, I don't think they're very good, Mr. Hamlisch. It's not going to happen. Right? So, yeah, no, it's the lessons that we learn, we could write a book,
It's like those are those beautiful gifts that are happening for you. It was like a beautifully humbling, you know, ego-crushing.
It was ego-crushing.
Gift.
Right?
Oh, yes.
I mean, well, we all have, and that's the other thing is, if you haven't had your time in the barrel, you're not in the barrel. Like, if you don't go through your batting slump, you're not in the major leagues. It comes for everybody. Right. Even Robert Redford. Even like it doesn't matter what actor, Jack Nicholson, who you are, you can look at anybody's filmography and go, wow, that's a cold streak. Or right. Because, and that's the gift of it, because if you're around long enough, the sheer math catches up with you.
Well, I think that's the thing in life that is, part of the illusion that we think that it's. You know, when you're sitting on the other side, you think it's like just about the wins, when nothing is and nothing stays at that level. And if it did, one, it would be really uninteresting. Like if you knew every time that you were going to hit it out of the park, pretty soon it would be really boring.
It's like that great episode of Twilight Zone with Sebastian Cabot, where the gambler has a heart attack in the casino and he wakes up in a room that's white. It's an all white casino. And there are hot women everywhere. And he's like, oh my God, this is everything I ever thought heaven would be. This is amazing. And he wins and he wins and he wins. And finally goes to Sebastian Cabot, who's like this, like the MC of the host, and says, hey, listen, I know that, you know, in heaven, all your dreams come true, but it'd really be interesting as a gambler. I need to feel the thing that there's a possibility that I might lose. So if you could arrange that maybe every once in a while I could lose. And Sebastian Cabot looks at him and says, what makes you think this is heaven?
Yeah, that's it. Like it's, you know, I can certainly say, you know, that my, my crashes are by far where I've had the greatest, you know, enlightenment, the greatest awakening, the greatest opportunity for knowing myself and facing myself and loving and learning to love myself. It's not, the wins aren't, you know, what have made me get closer to feeling good about me. I mean, they feel good and it's nice, but it's the, you know, it's when I've been at my lowest that I feel like I, you know, have become my greatest. So without it, you know, we would flatline. In a way, you're not alive.
So, I mean, this is why I love doing this podcast. I love it so much. I love to have people like you on who occupy such a big place in people's memory and consciousness, and then to be able to show the part of you that only people who really know you well ever get to see. You know, that part of you that I know and love, which is how unbelievably thoughtful you are and how hard you work on yourself. And have been since day one, and what an inspiration you've been to me.
Thank you.
This has been everything I thought it would be, and more. Really, truly, and more. See,
more,
get it? Wow, I hope that was as much fun for you guys as it was for me. I could have talked to her for another 5 days. There's just so much to cover in just her life and my history with her and our similarities and what we've been through. And but I hope it was what it was for you, pulling up a chair and being a fly on the wall of two old friends who've been through the wars together. I'm really proud of that episode. That was really fun. I had a blast. And thank you for being a part of it. Thank you for listening. And if you enjoyed it, go and give us a rating. Those ratings mean a lot, and I read them. So you better be nice, because sometimes your email is attached to them. I'm not saying I'll reach out to you, but I might. I'll see you next week on Literally with Rob Lowe.
You have been listening to Literally with Rob Lowe, produced and engineered by me, Devin Torrey Bryant. Executive produced by Rob Lowe for Low Profile, Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Colin Anderson and Chris Bannon at Stitcher. The supervising producer is Aaron Blair. Talent producer, Jennifer Samples. Please rate and review this show on Apple Podcasts, and remember to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This has been a Team Coco production, in association with Stitcher.
Hey, Keurig coffee drinkers. Need a cold coffee with a bold flavor? Dunkin' Cold K-Cup pods were specially crafted for cold coffee. Brew over ice straight out of the Keurig coffee maker for smooth, delicious Dunkin' taste you know and love. Find your next Dunkin' cold coffee in the roasted coffee aisle.